at Contra Podcast Conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you've ever looked around and wondered how humanity managed to be so brilliant and yet, well, so destructive, you are definitely in the right place today. We are diving deep, really deep, into Jared Diamond's landmark book, The Third Chimpanzee, Human Evolution and Nature.
Yeah, this is a book that really shakes things up. It fundamentally changes how you think about what it means to be human. And the core fact, the really astonishing thing, is that biologically speaking, we share 98.4% of our DNA with chimps and bonobos.
98.4%. And that tiny sliver, that little 1.6% difference, yeah. That's what somehow led to everything from, I don't know, the Mona Lisa to global warfare.
Exactly. It's this huge paradox. And our mission today, really, is to give you a shortcut to understanding it. How do our ancient evolutionary roots drive both our most incredible achievements and, honestly, our most terrifying modern problems? Understanding this is, well, it feels pretty essential for navigating the 21st century.
Right. So to get a handle on this huge idea, maybe we should start with the person behind it, Jared Diamond.
Good idea. He was born in 1937, and he's really the definition of a polymath, currently a professor of geography at UCLA. But his background is much wider. He actually holds a PhD in physiology and biophysics from Cambridge.
Physiology, biophysics, geography. And I know he's deep into evolutionary biology, ornithology, studying birds, and anthropology, too. That's quite a mix.
It really is. And you might wonder, like you suggested, if stretching across so many fields makes the analysis a bit thin.
Yeah, maybe superficial.
But that's where Diamond's real strength lies, I think. He avoids that by synthesizing rigorous data from all those fields. He blends hard science, you know, genetics, physiology, with decades of actual fieldwork. Studying bird evolution, yes, but also human societies, especially his long-term work in New Guinea.
So it's that combination, the lab precision and the real-world on-the-ground observation.
Exactly. That unique blend is why he's such a compelling guide for looking at our species as a whole.
Okay, so The Third Chimpanzee.
Yeah.
This was his first really big book for a general audience, right? Kind of laying the groundwork for guns, germs, and steel later on.
That's right. It sets the stage.
So what's the absolute core argument he's making in this foundational book?
It's actually quite simple, but also pretty humbling. He argues we need to strip away all the myths about humans being somehow separate or exceptional. We have to put ourselves firmly back into our biological context. We are an animal. A very peculiar one, yes, but still an animal constrained by our evolutionary past.
So it's about acknowledging our animal nature.
And crucially, recognizing that while our biological evolution has been, you know, relatively slow over millennia, our cultural evolution, our ability to learn, share knowledge, build on previous generations' discoveries that absolutely exploded, it happened incredibly fast.
Okay. So that's the key difference maker, not just a physical change, but this runaway cultural train.
Precisely. The book traces this whole journey, millions of years of it. It looks at what makes us unique language, art, complex technology. But it doesn't shy away from the dark side. It shows how those very same capabilities, almost inevitably, led to our destructive side, violence, environmental ruin.
Understanding both sides of that coin, that's the goal.
Yes, because you can't really tackle modern global challenges without grasping that deep dual nature.
Okay, let's dig into some of those key shifts then. That 1.6% genetic difference.
Yeah.
How did it create such a massive gap in behavior? We know we're genetically the third chimpanzee, basically. What was the big turning point?
Well, Diamond, like many others, points to something often called the Great Leap Forward. You see, for millions of years, the development of tools and technology was incredibly slow, almost static, geologically speaking. Then, relatively suddenly, around maybe 50,000 years ago, something changed dramatically. You get this explosion of complex tools, people spreading rapidly across the globe,
yeah.
Abstract art like cave paintings, jewelry.
It's like a switch flipped. A cognitive wildfire, as you put it.
Yeah, exactly. And Diamond argues the most probable trigger for this massive leap was the final development of complex syntactic language.
Language. Not just simple communication, but grammar, syntax, the ability to express complex, abstract ideas.
Exactly. Language is like the ultimate human superpower. It allows for incredibly detailed planning, cooperation on the scale never seen before in any species. Mm-hmm. And maybe most critically, it allows for the reliable, cumulative transmission of culture. knowledge could build upon itself generation after generation.
Right. So instead of each generation figuring things out from scratch, we could stand on the shoulders of giants, so to speak.
Precisely. And that's how you get from, you know, controlling fire in a cave to developing iPhones in what's really a blink of an eye in geological terms.
Okay, so language helps explain our tools, our spread, our culture. But Diamond also dives into the really personal stuff, right? Our rather bizarre life cycles and sexual behavior compared to other primates.
Oh, absolutely. He argues that just like language-enabled complex societies, our unique reproductive strategies evolved to support those complex social structures.
So, for example, concealed ovulation. The fact that human females don't advertise when they're fertile, that seems counterintuitive from a purely biological standpoint.
It does seem odd at first glance, doesn't it? Why hide that crucial information? But Diamond argues it's actually a social advantage.
How so?
Well, the thinking is it promotes continuous sexual receptivity, or at least interest, throughout the cycle. This helps strengthen long-term stable pair bonds between males and females. And why is that important? Because human babies are incredibly helpless and dependent for a very long time.
Much longer than other primate infants.
Way longer. So ensuring the survival of those kids really benefits from having both parents, or at least consistently invested caregivers, around for the long haul. Concealed ovulation, the theory goes, encourages males to stick around and invest.
Okay, that makes sense. It ties reproduction directly to long-term social stability.
Exactly. And speaking of long-term strategies, the grandmother hypothesis is another fascinating piece of this puzzle.
Right, this tackles menopause. Why do human females live so long past their reproductive years? Most animals don't.
It's a real evolutionary puzzle, but the grandmother hypothesis offers a pretty elegant explanation. Instead of continuing to compete reproductively late in life, when the risks might be higher and chances lower, older women shift their strategy. They boost their overall genetic legacy, their fitness, by investing heavily in their existing children, and especially their grandchildren.
So, helping their daughters raise the grandkids, providing resources, knowledge, childcare.
All of it. By increasing the survival rates of their grandchildren, who carry their genes, they potentially get a better evolutionary return than trying to have just one more child themselves in old age. It's cooperation across generations.
It's a really powerful idea. A win for cooperation, as you say.
Yeah.
But this success story, our ability to cooperate and build complex societies, it seems to have a really dark side.
It does. And that brings us to probably Diamond's most famous and certainly most controversial argument in the book.
The idea that the agricultural revolution, the invention of farming, was arguably the worst mistake in the history of the human race.
Yeah, that one definitely makes you stop and think. It completely flips the standard narrative, right? We usually celebrate agriculture as the dawn of civilization, the foundation of everything.
But Diamond lays out the hidden costs. What were they?
Well, for the average individual, the shift to farming often meant a significant decline in health. Diets became much less varied, heavily reliant on a few starchy staple crops. Plus, living in dense, permanent settlements close to domesticated animals that created the perfect breeding ground for infectious diseases. Epidemics became a major killer.
And it wasn't just physical health, was it? He talks about social changes, too.
Absolutely. With agriculture came surplus food, stored resources, and that quickly led to social stratification, inequality, hierarchies, and often a decline in the status of women compared to hunter-gatherer societies.
So civilization, as we know it, was kind of bought at a pretty high price for individual well-being and equality.
That's the argument. And we're still dealing with the consequences today through what Diamond and others call evolutionary mismatch.
Explain that a bit more. How does that mismatch play out now?
Well, basically, our brains and bodies evolved over millions of years in a hunter-gatherer environment. Our reward pathways, for instance, are wired to crave things that were rare but crucial for survival back then, like sugar, fat, salt.
Things that gave you quick energy or helped you store fat for lean times.
Exactly. But now, in the modern world, those things are hyper-abundant, cheap, easy to get, everywhere.
Right. So my Stone Age brain screams, yes.
Yeah.
To that extra donut, because it registers rare, high-energy food, even though my rational 21st century mind knows it's not good for me in large quantities.
Precisely. Modern life bombards us with these super stimuli, highly concentrated versions of things our biology craves. Our ancient wiring just hasn't caught up and has no natural defense against this onslaught, whether it's processed foods, addictive drugs, or even constant social media notifications.
That constant struggle, It makes a lot more sense through that evolutionary lens. But this destructive capacity, it isn't just personal, is it? It plays out on a much larger scale, too.
Tragically, yes. Diamond uses the example of Easter Island Rapa Nui as this sort of chilling case study, a microcosm of potential global disaster.
The story there is just heartbreaking. The population grew, they cut down all the trees to transport their giant statues and for other resources.
And in doing so, they destroyed their own ecosystem. They lost the ability to build ocean-going canoes for fishing, soil eroded, resources dwindled, and their society eventually collapsed into warfare and potentially cannibalism. They literally engineered their own downfall.
It's a stark warning. But is it fair to use one isolated island as a template for the whole globe? We have global communication now, scientific understanding. Surely we know better.
That's the hope, isn't it? But Diamond argues that this pattern of humans causing ecological damage, even to their own detriment, isn't new. It's ancient. He points to evidence like the extinctions of large mammals, the megafauna that consistently followed human arrival in places like North America, the Clovis people, and Australia tens of thousands of years ago.
So the argument is, we've always tended to prioritize short-term exploitation over long-term sustainability wherever we went.
It seems to be a recurring theme in our history, unfortunately. Our awareness doesn't always translate into effective action, especially when dealing with collective problems.
Okay, so environmental destruction is an old habit.
Mm.
What about our moral failings? Things like genocide, extreme violence between groups. Does Diamond connect that back to our evolution, too?
He does, and this is perhaps one of the most profoundly uncomfortable parts of the book. He suggests that the roots of xenophobia, fear of outsiders, and lethal aggression towards other groups are deeply embedded in our primate heritage.
You mean he looks at chimpanzee behavior? Things like their coordinated lethal raids on neighboring chimp groups?
Exactly. He sees parallels between that kind of chimpanzee warfare and boundary defense, and the fundamental psychological tendencies that underpin human tribalism and conflict.
That's quite a claim, that the capacity for something as horrific as genocide might have roots in our shared ancestry with chimps.
It's disturbing, yeah. The argument isn't that it's inevitable, but that the potential, the psychological wiring for strong us versus them thinking and lethal intergroup conflict might be part of our evolutionary baggage. The terrifying difference today, of course, is our technology and social organization. They allow us to scale up that ancient impulse to a truly catastrophic level.
Wow. Okay. So, stepping back from the specific examples, this book really provides a powerful, if sometimes unsettling, framework for understanding ourselves and our world. What are the main themes, the big takeaways we should hold on to?
I think the first and maybe most fundamental is simply humans are animals first. We have to acknowledge our biological nature, recognizing that our behaviors, cooperation, aggression, status seeking, forming groups have parallels in the animal kingdom isn't demeaning. It's actually essential self-knowledge.
And reflecting on that, it could help make sense of things we see every day, right? Like office politics or social dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they aren't purely rational, but also driven by these deeper primal instincts.
Exactly. The second big theme is that evolutionary mismatch we talked about. Our Stone Age brains are constantly struggling to cope with modern life. This helps explain why we find it so hard to deal with long-term, abstract threats like climate change, while we're easily drawn to immediate gratification, that sugary drink, the quick purchase. Our priorities are skewed by our evolutionary past.
So we need to consciously design systems and habits to counteract those built-in biases.
We do. And the third key theme really tackles history and society, the moral neutrality of history. Diamond argues forcefully that the historical dominance of certain societies like Eurasian ones wasn't due to any innate biological or intellectual superiority. It was largely down to what he calls geographical luck.
Meaning having access to the right kinds of plants and animals that could be easily domesticated.
Precisely. The availability of domesticable species in Eurasia gave those societies a huge head start in developing agriculture, dense populations, technology, and resistance to diseases. It wasn't about being inherently better people.
That's such an important point. It's a powerful science-based counterargument to racism and ethnocentrism. It puts different societies' histories down to environmental factors, not biology.
Absolutely critical takeaway.
Diamond is also really good at phrasing these big ideas in ways that stick with you. Can we highlight a few key quotes or central ideas that really capture the essence of the book?
Definitely. The first one hammers home our biological place. We're accustomed to thinking of ourselves as the only humans alive today, but in fact, we're not. There are also two species of chimpanzees alive today, and they're more closely related to us than they are to the other great apes.
It just forces you to see yourself not as separate, but as part of that primate family tree.
Yeah.
Just a slightly different branch.
Yeah. Then there's one about our social structures. The values that we live by are the values that were appropriate to the band and village life that all our ancestors lived until almost yesterday.
That explains so much about why modern life often feels difficult, why managing huge anonymous societies and global politics feels so unnatural and fragile. Our core programming is for small, tight-knit groups.
Exactly. And finally, the core paradox, the double-edged sword of our nature. The traits that make us uniquely human are the very same traits that have given us the power to exterminate other species and each other on a scale never before seen.
Our intelligence, our creativity, our ability to cooperate, they are inseparable from our capacity for destruction. That's sobering.
It really is. The genius and the danger are two sides of the same coin.
Okay, so for someone listening, having absorbed all this, this deep evolutionary perspective, how can they actually apply it? How does this knowledge change things day to day beyond just being interesting?
Well, one very practical area is lifestyle design. That evolutionary mismatch concept is gold here. Understanding that your body is fundamentally designed for lots of movement, a diverse diet, low in processed sugars, that's step one to better health. It helps you realize it's not just about willpower. You need to shape your environment to support your biology, not fight against it.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Stop blaming yourself so much and start changing the context. What about bigger picture stuff, like conflict?
Diamond's insights into tribalism are really useful for conflict resolution. If we know we have this powerful innate tendency to form in-groups and out-groups, then one strategy for overcoming conflict, especially global challenges, is to consciously try and broaden the definition of. Emphasizing common threats like climate change or pandemics can help forge a larger shared human identity, leveraging our cooperative instincts for survival rather than division.
Using our tribalism for good, essentially, by making the tribe all humans facing this threat.
Kind of, yeah. And there's another lesson, more about organizations and society, from the cautionary tale of the Tasmanians losing technologies.
Right, they became isolated, their population perhaps dropped below a critical threshold, and they actually lost valuable skills over time, like making fire or certain tools.
Exactly. It highlights the importance of organizational resilience. In our incredibly complex, specialized modern world, we need large enough networks and enough redundancy to prevent the loss of critical knowledge and skills, especially with technology. It's a lesson in managing complexity and avoiding catastrophic knowledge gaps.
That's a really practical warning for businesses, governments, even scientific communities.
Yeah.
Don't let essential knowledge become too concentrated or fragile. For me, reflecting on all this, the thing that hits hardest is maybe the sense of profound humility it inspires, and maybe awe, realizing that we, Homo sapiens, are this incredibly improbable outcome of evolution. So successful, yet so deeply constrained by ancient biological wiring. It makes our existence feel both precarious and amazing.
I completely agree. And the final thought I'd leave listeners with is one of urgency, I suppose, and choice. Diamond's work highlights that we are quite possibly the very first generation of humans to have the scientific tools to understand our deep history, our trajectory, and the evolutionary forces shaping us. And because of the scale of our impact now, we might also be the last generation with a real chance to use that understanding to steer away from potential catastrophe. Ultimately, our future survival probably depends entirely on whether we can make conscious, rational choices to manage the consequences of our own remarkable and dangerous success.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.